Hey, y'all, you're back. Jackie, you want to tell the people what's up?
Hey, everybody. Today we hear from Alexandria Cunningham, who talks with us about Black women and eroticism.
Also, we speak with Nigerian-American artist Dawn Okoro about her amazing art exhibit, Punk Noir, here in Austin, and more. All right, you ready?
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about bumps into. Let's talk about making love.
You know, I used to get in trouble for listening to that song when I was little.
Yeah, because we were entirely too young to be listening to Pretty Ricky, but Pretty Ricky, as my friend Leah says, Pretty Ricky deserves at least a BET Award for that special.
Honestly, at least. And honestly, at 22, I'm still too young to be listening to Pretty Ricky, but whatever.
Say it loud.
Oh, look at that proud.
Yeah. Say it loud.
Oh, I'm black and I'm proud.
One more time for Rodney King. Say it loud.
Oh, I'm black and I'm proud.
Yeah. You're lucky it's Black History Month, or it would have been a lot worse.
Alexandria Cunningham is a graduate student in African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas in Austin.
Alexandria's work focuses on Black feminism, Black sexual politics, fantasy and eroticism, sexual economics, hip-hop, and popular and strip club culture.
And she was so kind enough to stop by and chat for a bit. And to start, she tells us what made her even start looking into this area of study.
I always had a really deep interest in studying Black folks and in a contemporary light, right? Because a lot of my friends do work on slavery and Afrofuturism, but I wanted to find a way to kind of speak to where my experiences fall as a woman in the 21st century, dealing with social media and music and people saying crazy foolishness. And so I wanted to do work that reflects where I'm at and the kinds of issues and things that I'm thinking through. And Black Studies just offers a really great and fun way to do that with really brilliant Black people. My mom was the person that really got me to kind of think about the ways in which I wanted to put my work together. So, full disclosure, I like really foul hip hop music, like Juvenile's Back That Thing Up, Juicy J, and some of the more suggestive older stuff. And so one day my mom heard me listening to that kind of music and she's like, you know what? The feminists will never have you. Like, you just can't, the ways in which you love this kind of degrading music to women would never resonate with what the so-called feminists have to say or understand about sexuality and gender and all these other things, right? And so I needed a way to kind of make sense to my own mom, like, there is a way to claim feminism if that's of interest to me. I still haven't decided if I want to identify as a feminist, though I understand the value of feminism and certainly use it in my work. But, you know, I also want to keep backing my thing up, too, if that's what speaks to me and to the ways in which I understand the world. I think there's a place to have both and more if that's what we want.
I would like to say that I, too, backed that thing up while fighting for women's rights, and she made me feel a little bit better about this.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's a classic song, and even the Houston remix, which I'm pretty sure you might not know, but that's
excuse
neither
me?
Here nor there.
You act like I didn't grow up 2 hours right.
You a shot caller, won't you ride with me? Shopping speed, spinning G's, won't you ball with me? You don't know it because you didn't join in, but it's okay.
Honestly, I know the song, Jackie. I just know the lyrics.
It's
feel judged.
Okay.
Anyway,
but
moving on.
Back to Alexandria. Alexandria jumps right into the relationship between eroticism and Black women.
The biggest tying thread is definitely what I'm calling racial and sexual mythology. So basically these archetypes that come out of race and out of gender to basically explain performances, right? So the Jezebel stereotype, for example, that Patricia Hill Collins always talks about, that comes from enslavement era rhetoric about Black women being needed to be controlled and about justifying the ways in which access to their bodies through white men in particular, how that could be a thing, right? So rather than white men saying, oh, well, I'm attracted to black women and that's something that I want to be engaged in, right? If you just say, well, this person isn't even a person and they're hyper accessible anyway, and they're just so wanton and so desirous that, you know, it's just the universe falling into my lap, right? That provides particular kinds of justifications that get saturated, right? And the Jezebel has been one of the longest stereotypes that black women have had to combat. Similarly for black men, the sexually potent black man, right? And needing to control his movement so that it doesn't cause a threat to the purity of white womanhood, but also threaten white male property, right? And we take these mythologies and they get refashioned and rearticulated, right? You could literally draw lines between those kind of stereotypes and like the thug stereotype, right? Or the stripper stereotype, which is kind of like a rearticulation of the Jezebel and thinking about that. So at the most basic level, those are some continuities, but also thinking about how black women function as sexual attractions and spectacles, right? So if we think of Disney World and like the thrill that that offers, right? Black women have oftentimes been marketed similarly, thinking about Sarah Bartman, for example, and her literally being a freak show, but that being an international kind of attraction for folks to engage in. Josephine Baker, who was born in America, but did banana dances in France, but was on postcards all around the world, thinking about all the other instances in which black women are offered a literal stage to display their bodies and display something that is incredibly sensuous that no other body literally inhabits. Like, those are things that feed those kind of mythologies that get picked up and are very powerful for folks to hold on to, right? And that kind of animates, I think, contemporary thinking because we don't let that go, right? And then we find other outlets to then saturate and make those things even more popular.
Jackie, have you ever been approached by like a guy with a corny pickup line about black beauty? And if you did, how did you handle the situation?
I mean, of course, I'm a black woman with natural hair. Of course, I've had so many guys come up to me calling me a black queen, saying all this stuff, either commenting on what I'm wearing. And honestly, I ignore them because I don't need you in my life, like at all. What about you?
Yeah, same here. Especially, I get a lot of comments about my skin, but also because I'm like 6 foot and I'm a black woman, and I think that makes it even worse. I always get compared to like an Amazon, or I always get told that I'm like a beautiful, statuesque, you know, black queen. And I'm just like, thanks. I see where your heart is. I understand that I am a queen, but I don't need you to acknowledge that.
I think
thanks.
It's a difference in the way that men approach you, because sometimes if a man comes up and they're just like, you're very attractive, it's like, oh, mm-hmm. thank you so much, and leave it at that. But when
exactly.
you come up doing the extra and the most, I'm like,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like, I'm like, okay, why? But why?
Down.
But why are we
now,
doing
have
this?
Have you ever had a man not even say anything to you, but the look that he gave you, it was just like, he gave you that nasty
yeah,
up
like
and
he's
down.
Looking at you like a piece
like
of meat.
Like a piece of meat. Like, what? No. What do you think this is?
No. Oh, girl, my stank face is on another level. When I tell you, you can smell it from across the room because I make sure I give
you
it very clearly.
You know I'm not even
going
to come over here, to be honest.
Exactly.
Because I'm with my girls.
Exactly.
I don't want you in my face.
Exactly.
Yes. I think she also makes an interesting comment about the sexual suppression of black women when she talks about how we're often kind of forced into these two boxes. You know, you're either a Jezebel, which means you're overly accessible and obtainable, or sometimes you're almost this over-fetishized pure black woman. And so it's really hard to navigate growing up, especially in the South where, you know, abstinence is pushed so heavily.
Yes.
It's really hard to kind of even get a nuanced look at what black woman sexuality is.
Yeah, it is. And then also to have not only these narratives or these characteristics pushed on you by men, but also by the women in your family too, right?
Yes.
Always
yeah.
being too fast, always being too hot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even for doing simple things like wearing hoop earrings, right? Or just wearing
yeah.
shorts,
that's
right?
That's too grown. That's
yeah,
too grown.
Exactly. And you know, Alexandra continues to expand on this weird fascination with black women's bodies and our visibility. And she also touches on how when people are talking about black women, they rarely talk about it about us without being sexualized.
In the same way that you can kind of like sign a document and you can see scribble but you can't make it out, I think that's how black women's eroticism is kind of put in the public imagination, right? So something that can exist either with or without context. So what does it mean for me to be able to say Black women's eroticism and people not necessarily know what that means? But then I say a name like Black China or Amber Rose or Gabrielle Union or something like that, and then people might have an inkling of what I'm talking about, right? Because there's a particular image or a particular understanding that comes up with a little bit of context. But if I take that context away, then all of a sudden we might not know what I'm talking about. And so I think the ways in which Black women are made invisible is that we can't see Black women sometimes without having this inherently sexual conversation. Like, if I was just talking about Black women as intellectuals and saying, you know, Gabrielle Union has a fabulous book in which she talks about feminist politics and sexual politics and all these other things, but then took the sex away, would people still be interested in that kind of conversation? Or think that I was the person, you know, to host that kind of conversation if I removed all the thrill of the sex and the eroticism around it? I don't know. And I think that happens at a discursive level, too. You know, like, people don't want to talk about the ways in which Black China was manipulated and forcibly pushed out of the Kardashian clan. And I personally think she gave it a really good effort to try and be in that family and be in her partnership. Of course, not without critique. But, you know, there are other things to talk about other than just she was on the gram doing such and such and such, and she cheated and she was exposed and all these other things. But again, what part of that is legible? What part of that is understandable if we were to shadow some of that stuff out?
I really like the comment that she talked about when she brought up, you know, Black China, Amber Rose, and then, you know, the Kardashian clan, because it also opens up this conversation that the more money and the more access and luxury that you have, the more open or you're allowed to be with mm-hmm. your sexuality and freedom. Because mm-hmm. we can look at women like Amber Rose and automatically she's a slut and she's this.
Yeah.
But then Kim Kardashian can do this, and it's that's her
she's
art.
Business
that's her
savvy.
Work,
she's a business woman.
She's business, and that's what she's supposed to do. And it's like, I can't remember, I think it was Pink said something like negative about Amber Rose.
Yeah.
And Amber Rose was like, honestly, who are you to say anything about me? You dance around in tights as well. So a man can say the same thing about you and call you a slut. The only thing difference is the amount of money behind it. So
exactly.
Why is it okay for you to do it and not okay for me?
Exactly.
And I think
exactly.
that just opens up a really big conversation that we need, that needs to be had at the end of the day.
Yeah, because if Amber Rose were, I mean, I think that we accept her as Black. You know, if Amber Rose had been any other color, you know, would this have been the same conversation? Would this have been called sexual freedom, you know?
No, not at all. It would have just been her brand. Yeah. Her being sexual like that, it would have been something that men loved. You know, but her being a Black woman, we often have not only other people, but also Black people talking down on her for the way
exactly.
that she is. And
exactly.
The freedom she has.
And kind of like going on, you know, kind of skipping over into mainstream, Alexandra, she did a capstone titled Hip Hop Sexual Anthems, But Only If You Nasty, Unpacking Black Sexual Politics in the New Racism. And through it, she expands on this ideal of invisibility for Black women, but through Nicki Minaj.
Yeah, and the title is pretty self-explanatory, but in her work, she talks about this situation that happened with Madame Tussauds, which is basically a chain of museums around the world that showcases celebrity wax figures.
Yeah, and last year, they came under criticism for making an ugly wax figure of our deity herself, Queen Bee, that looked like Lindsay Lohan with blonde hair.
It was disrespectful. And about 3 years back, they were under fire for making a wax figurine of Nicki Minaj on all fours. And I mean, it was inspired by her Anaconda video, which is, of course, one of her most popular songs and videos. And Nicki approved it, but tourists were taking obscene photos with the figurine, which resulted in them having to remove it and having to tweak the exhibit all over again so it wouldn't happen.
Nicki is the only figure that they've ever made that's on all fours. No other woman figure in anywhere that Madame Tussauds has done has been on all fours, but Nicki is, and she's a Black woman. Also, the background is a jungle background, evoking these, once again, colonial kinds of interpretations of African women as bestial and as animals. She's in gold chains. Again, we could have the conversation about chains and slavery and what that kind of imagery looks like. And so Nicki kind of didn't respond to all of that, but then the figure got security guards, which folks like E! Online were calling booty guards, and like all this joking around the security of the figure and how we understand that. And then people were still coming and doing the very same things that caused for all this uproar to begin with, right? And so I think the question in all that is to understand, well, what is it about the figure that is allowing people to experience something that they feel entitled to? What is the relationship between audience and performer, and how is the lyrical here kind of intervening and creating fantasies and otherworldly spaces in which people feel like they want to lay claim to, right? And then what is even the security around that?
So this part of the interview is a great transition for speaking about hip hop and the way Black women are hypersexualized in this area. And it also makes me and D'Elia feel a little trash for, you know, dancing to some of our songs and our provocative lyrics that we dance to.
Some of the new work that I'm doing is definitely around theorizing pornography and thinking through the ways in which hip hop and porn, once they come together as hip hop porn, kind of makes sense. So Murray Miller Young wrote this book called A Taste for Brown Sugar, Black Women in Pornography in 2014 that has really been insightful for thinking through those kinds of things. And she talks about two pornographic films called Let Me Tell You About White Chicks from 1984 and Let Me Tell You About Black Chicks from 1985, which are interracial features, and they deal with caricatures of Black life and Black sexuality and eroticism that I think are really illustrative to think about, because the producer of them and the person that designed them, he goes by Gregory Dark, and he's no longer producing pornographic films, but the ways in which he views himself as an artist and his artistic approach depends on a certain level of performative absurdity. So he's very much so interested in racial caricatures and pushing people to their absolute limits and thinking through that, right?
And this is a white man, correct?
This is a white man.
Okay.
Who also has produced music videos for pop artists like Aaron Carter's little sister, Britney Spears, and he did a rap video for Exhibit, like one of his very first music videos. And so there's that convergence to talk about and how, like, the artistic and aesthetic eye in pornography functions for hip hop, but then also to think about the ways in which porn actresses and actors also kind of appear in these music videos too, like Tupac's How Do You Want It with Casey and JoJo, like that has Jeannie Pepper in it, who is one of the most prolific Black porn actresses that there is, and she's in it. And again, in terms of porn and hip hop both being interested in performance and talking about conspicuous consumption in a particular kind of way and about creating images of alternate lifestyles that are mediated by sex and sexuality in very key ways, I think they have a really interesting convergence that should be theorized, right? Because people are also looking to porn at a logistic level to understand how to perform or what's the new thing to do, what's the new trend to get with.
So Jackie, how do you feel about the way Black women are depicted in music videos and films? You know, to you, are we essentially sexually liberated? Are we simply being used as props?
I think it's we're kind of in a little bit, I see both. I honestly see both, because then I can see videos like Nice for What, where you see like these beautiful Black women just dancing around and being themselves in their bodies, you know, Misty Copeland, just her beautiful body in a way that's not sexualized, and appreciating.
Same thing with Issa
women.
Rae.
Yeah.
Issa Rae, you know, just gives a glance to the camera,
yeah,
right? But she's not overly sexualized.
You know, and I see things like that, but then I also watch like TV shows and I hear Rick Ross saying that I could never sign a woman to my label because then I'd have to have sex with her. And it's just, it's disgusting, and it's excluding, because it's like, because I don't want to have sex with you, I can't, I can't be on your label, you know? So I kind of see both. Definitely. What about you?
Yeah, I think that I kind of see both as well. I think that also we're kind of like a lot more conscious of the way that we're depicted. You know, I'm not saying that we weren't at first, but I think that, you know, America as a whole is a lot more conscious of the way that we've been depicted. You know, you have people who are going, you know, you have Time's Up movements, right? You have the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. You have Black women actively voicing their opinions on men like Bill Cosby. And you have, you know, people like R. Kelly. And I think that whenever you're dealing with like men like that, yeah, I could see where, you know, that we could be simply used as a prop, right? Or, you know, just used in general. But also I see women like Janelle Monáe, for example, who just released Dirty Computer, who, and this is when she openly, you know, said that she's pansexual, right? Like, you see her doing it very mm-hmm. freely and without, you know, any apology about it. So I kind of see that. I feel like we're doing both, you know, being kind of sexually freer than we were once before. But I think that we still have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, and definitely. And what's kind of weird is that out of our examples, most of the things that we see being sexually liberated are often coming from women, which is beautiful exactly. to see. It's a lot of women, especially with Janelle Monáe's Pink, where she has mm-hmm. girls, you know, not
wearing vaginas,
but just promoting the vagina. And like, it's like pink is what's hot. Like, pink is, it's cool if you got blue, but we got pink, and cool, you know, that's what matters. And then, but I also see Black women that are like, especially within Black rap, and it's like, I'm gonna talk about my sexuality in a way mm-hmm. of that I enjoy sex, and it's very wonderful and enjoyable for me, and it's not in a way that's objectifying me, it's the way that I claim it, it's my exactly. sexuality, and I'm very comfortable with it. And I think yeah. that's wonderful to see, because, you know, back then, I mean, of course we had our Lil' Kims and stuff like that, but you know yeah. it's definitely growing way more.
Yeah, exactly. I was just talking the other day about how I've been like literally binge listening to female hip hop artists mm-hmm. Over the past month, and it has been quite great. And I also feel sexier listening to them, right? And I feel a lot more comfortable in my skin because these women are very, you know, intentional about talking about how their bodies are theirs, right? And how, like, mm-hmm. in a way, they sometimes flip the tables on men. And it's kind of comforting to hear lyrics like that, honestly.
I once read somewhere that, like, white women are able to be sexually liberated while Black women do the work for them to be sexually liberated. And that has always stuck with me for a couple of reasons. So I think we have to trouble the end goal, right? I'm all for sexual liberation and I'm all for sexual freedom. But I also recognize that the very concept of freedom and liberation is inherent on somebody's unfreedom. And I want to have a critical politic around that that says, how do we reach a point where one's freedom is not predicated on another person's oppression, right? So then I think we have to talk about what is the end goal here, and also understand the ways in which we conceive of space and what are the spaces in which we are meant to be liberated, right? Because for me, I don't personally want to do like the walk at night where I don't have a shirt on and do whatever. That for me is not a part of my feminist approach to doing this kind of work, because I have particular anxieties about being in the street like that. And other Black women do too, and other women of color. And so I think we have to be real intentional about the spaces, right? Like, for me, I would love to be able to get on public transit and not be catcalled, right? Or like, if I curb somebody's advances, I would like for that to be respected. Or if I can just honestly say, like, this is what I'm seeking and it's not necessarily a monogamous long-term relationship, that just be cool and it not be, oh, well, you must be such and such and such and such. And so now let's have all of these really sexually explicit alternatives, right? So I think we need to theorize space differently. I think we need to theorize the end goal differently. And I think people just really need to be more honest, you know? And there are ways to do that. I get it. You know, everyone thinks the conversation about sex and sexuality, let me not say everyone. It is common that the idea of having the conversation around sex and sexuality is a one-off kind of thing where it's not. And so when I have this conversation in a more like education-based kind of way, it's from the second that children are born, and if there are multiple people in the house, they can see affection and they can see the ways in which sexuality works. They don't necessarily have to bear witness to sexual activity, but kissing is part of sexuality. Holding hands, being affectionate, being communicative, these kinds of things are all at play. So I really tell people, like, use teachable moments, right? Like, more things in your life are relevant to having these kinds of critical discussions than anything. Use humor. You know, a good laugh really helps to get through awkward things. You know, we've been laughing this whole time and having a splendid time with it, you know, or just finding different and alternative ways to kind of go and recap things. So, like, I've done the dating apps kind of thing. And when it goes completely bad, rather than rant about it and be like, oh my God, I hate people, I go and do story time And I put it on my Facebook page and I make it really, really funny because oftentimes it is. And people love it. Like, I literally get calls like, I hope another story time post is coming because it's hilarious. Sometimes they're like holiday themed. Sometimes they're just extra petty for no reason. And it's a really great way to talk about difficult things, right? Like getting unsolicited pics of things that you don't want to see and being like, oh, well, you don't know. I could be the shadow man or the boogeyman. And what does that politic of just sending stuff randomly, like, what does that mean? And I think it lends to really fruitful conversation that then people want to share and do on their own kind of way. And that's nothing that I have to go and teach seminars to do.
So did you ask her the question that we have to ask everybody?
Jackie, I'm so sick of you because I feel like every single time we have this conversation, you have trust issues. You act like I don't know what I'm doing.
I do.
You act like I ain't got no sense. You act like my brain is smaller than a peanut. And I'm sick of
that
it.
That is not
of it. Of course. You know, I asked her, how do you feel about Beyonce?
Looking at Beyonce as the god, right, it almost puts her beyond critique. And I don't think anybody is beyond critique, including myself. So I tend to stay away from trying to theorize Beyonce because I don't reach that high in the upper echelons of like people to touch. But I think she's important because she has opened a whole lot of doors performatively, business-wise. Like, she's done a lot. And her last few albums have been really compelling to my work insofar as thinking about how do we have a respectable Black woman figure, right? That everybody across class, race, all this other stuff can kind of equally vouch for as the bomb. How do we then understand her when the performances start looking different, right? So when she starts wearing box braids down to her ankles, when she does a whole album that's about being really sexual and sensual with her husband, or what it looks like when they're cheating and no longer in love and actively struggling and when she's trying to find herself.
You can find Alexandria on Twitter at @AllyDreams_12. That's at @AllyDreams_12.
My name is Dawn Okoro, and I'm an artist living in Austin, Texas. And I mainly focus on painting. I paint people, mostly women, and I use like bright, saturated colors in my work. I'm a Texan. I'm at least a fifth generation Texan on my mom's side, and I was born in Houston, Texas, but I didn't grow up there. I grew up in Lubbock, Texas, and then once I graduated high school, I left as soon as I could, and I came to Austin, where I went to UT, and I've been in Austin on and off ever since then. There was some stints in Houston and in New York, but I call Austin home. And so growing up, you know, in Lubbock, Texas, which is a pretty small city, I didn't really get to see a lot. So I got to imagine what the world would be like just through fashion magazines. So my mom would get like, well, it started with Ebony, which is not a fashion magazine, but they would have a fashion section, and I would open that up, and there would be like, they would show like the Black designers and Black models. And so I really got inspired by that. And then I started looking at fashion magazines, and I started off drawing like some of the ads, or putting my own touch to it, even like as a teen. And then eventually I got to the point of like taking like some of the white models and repainting them as like Black models for a painting. And then so I was really just love looking at fashion editorials and just the way that they're styled. And I later learned that I guess I like the style of certain photographers, Richard Avedon, Steven Meisel. They all, you know, did a lot of like the popular fashion campaigns in the 70s, 80s, and 90s especially. But eventually I got to the point where I started just photographing my own models and then using those as image references. But I mostly paint women, and maybe because I grew up really looking at a lot of like women's, you know, fashion magazines and just wanted to paint what I wanted to see, and maybe more of like a representation of myself. For me personally, like, it was, I don't know what it is, but I've always been, I guess you could say, like, different. Like, people think of me as, like, quiet, you know, maybe. And when I was younger, I felt, you know, shy. And I was always just drawn to, like, I don't know, the quirky things. Maybe I was a quirky person. But in Lubbock, it's like, Lubbock is a very conservative town. There's a small black population, but it's very, very conservative. Like, it, and so if you don't act or dress a certain way, then you like stick out like a sore thumb. So I really, really stuck out. So that's one of the reasons I was happy to, you know, move to Austin, and then eventually moved to New York for a while, which I really felt great there because it felt like anything goes, you know. So I just wanted a place to just sort of just be myself. For a long time, I drew or painted images that looked like something that would be out of a fashion magazine, like, you know, just sort of being inspired by editorials and then painting something like that. And I started wanting to explore, you know, different themes a few years ago. A couple years ago, I started a series that was called Misogynoir Resistance, and with that, I was thinking about video models, a lot of my work is kind of inspired by things that influenced me as a teen growing up in Lubbock. So I would, you know, watch MTV and then, you know, see these you know, ladies dancing around, like, you know, in the background or whatever, or like sort of like used as props in the video. So I wanted to explore that, and so what I did was get some models to pose for me, but they were kind of like pretending to be sort of like video models or projecting that image. And then initially during that time, I wanted to pose them to sort of be a video model, but sort of convey power. But when I look back at the photographs I took, is for whatever reason, it didn't really show that. It just looked like, you know, like a video model, you know. So I wanted to find a way to try to push back against that. And so I painted the women, and then I scratched them out. So like I would like take a certain contrasting color of paint and like scratch part of it out. And so I started doing more of that, and eventually I moved on to doing gold leaf drawings, not drawings, I'm sorry, paintings. And then I would sort of scratch the models out with the gold leaf. The reason I started using gold leaf is because with these video models, a lot of times, like, they're sort of just seen as like just objects and like not worth much more than like their bodies. And so I wanted to give a sense of value by using gold, because, like, you know, back in, like, using gold leaf dates back to like ancient times, like in, you know, ancient Egypt, it was used like to, you know, to convey like goddesses or like a deity or something like that. So that's why I use gold leaf. And so when I did these gold leaf paintings recently, some of the models are women that I posed myself, but some of the models are actual video models. So I took like a screenshot from like a 90s music video, or used like an album cover. Like, one of the images is called Power, and it's based off of Ice-T's album cover from like the early 90s, and it shows like his girlfriend at the time posed with like this big like shotgun, and then I scratched part of it out with gold leaf. Now I'm working on a series that's called Punk Noir, and I have some big paintings at the Carver Museum, and I'm also working on some smaller pieces that are an extension of that. But this is a little bit different for me because I'm also, you know, painting men as well as women. I focus so much on painting women for so long, and then I don't know, when I wanted to paint something that related to like Afropunk expression, I felt that to complete it, I needed to include people of all genders, and so that's how that came about. Even though the paintings in the Carver Museum are right now are mostly women, there are like three men included, but the pieces are like all people that I consider friends and people that I feel like have a punk spirit. My solo exhibition Punk Noir is on view at the Carver Museum in Austin. And those are large scale paintings, like 6 foot tall, and it's about Afropunk expression, and it's just very colorful, vivid. The walls are painted to match the paintings, and that will be on view through July 21st.
You can find Dawn and her work on Twitter and Instagram at Dawn Okoro, that's spelled DawnOkoro, and her website, okorostudio.com. Well, that's the end of the show.
Make sure to tell your friends about us and follow us on Twitter at The To and Fro and on Facebook.
Music by Honey Banks. Follow her on Twitter at Miss Chris Honeybee.
Also, remember to rate us wherever you listen to your podcast. And please send us any comments or suggestions for the show at thetoandfropodcast@gmail.com. Dalia, do you have anything to leave the peoples with today?
A broke clock is right twice a day.
Except when it comes to Kanye West.
Amen.
Bye. Bye.